This is the Wheeler Centre podcast. It's Saturday, 28th of November, 2015, and we at the Wheeler Centre are in the middle of the Interrobang, our new festival driven entirely by questions you submitted at our website. It's been a huge day of talks exploring that space between questions and answers, and we wanted to quickly share one of today's talks. Check out the interrobang.wheelercentre.com to find out more about the festival, and if you're listening today in Melbourne, why don't you come and join us? Anyway, here's our first session.
Why be good? As if I ever have been. Questions of work, love and feminism. Before I get to some of the questions that have come from all of you, which I mean not necessarily all of you sitting here, but anyone who submitted a question, allow me to introduce the panel. To start with, I'm Jane Caro and I'm the... what's that word? Interlocutor? Let's say. I'm going to boss them around. And joining me to answer these questions, my questions, and later on your questions, directly your questions, are the wonderful Nakia Louie, who is a writer, actor, and producer of course, ABC's wonderful black comedy. Can we welcome Nakia? Next to Nakia is Sally Warhaft.
No, I'm here.
No, you're there. Yeah. Where are you? I don't know where you are, Sally. I've lost you.
Neither do I.
I wrote this out in the order I met them rather than the order they're seated, so hence the confusion. Next to Nakia is Megan Dorm. Megan is an opinion columnist with the LA Times. She's the author of The Unspeakable, which I desperately need to read, and also the editor of Selfish, Shallow and Self-Absorbed, 16 Writers on the Decision Not to Have Children. Obviously a book close to David Lanholm's heart. Next to Megan is Sally Warhaft, who is broadcaster, writer and host of the Fifth Estate series right here at the Wheeler Centre and probably well known to many of you. And besides Sally is Geraldine Brooks. Before she went over to the dark side, as she expressed it, and began making things up, she wrote Nine Parts of Desire about Muslim women, and this was a result of her time as a foreign correspondent, particularly in the Middle East. Can you welcome... you should have applauded them all individually, but Nakia was just the lucky one. She got the individual applause. They're just getting general applause. Could you welcome her? Now, I'm going to cherry pick some of the questions here because I've got the job to do it and so I can. And the first one I want to ask the panel is, why is feminism still a dirty word? Geraldine, start with you.
Because there's still a lot of schmucks in the world. I think also... women got conned into not owning feminism and having it defined for us instead of sticking to our own definition of what it is. And so therefore people would tell us what a feminist was, and generally speaking we were told it was a man-hating, a boiler suit-wearing person with moles and BO.
Mm. And what do you think it is, Geraldine, rather than that?
I think it's obviously somebody who believes that women have the same human rights as men.
Thank you. Sally, why do you think it's a dirty word, or still, or do you think it is?
I do, and I mean, really what Geraldine said, it's dirty because the world is still dirty. But I think too, it's for a lot of women that word is just as troubling as it may be to men. And it's just going to remain fraught until this little problem in our human rights is sorted out, which means for a long time. And I mean, it seems every generation we expect the fraughtness or the dirtiness to leave, and it doesn't, because things aren't really improving that much. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're going backwards in many parts of the world.
Yeah. What do you think, Megan?
You know, I think it it's not as dirty at this moment as it has been. I mean, I have been really interested to see how, like, in the last 20 years, there's been, it's not even an evolution, it's sort of these waves that, you know, so, like, when I was in college about 20 years ago, or more, unfortunately, 23 or 4 years ago, there was a kind of need to dissociate from the word, and I wonder if that was because, you know, Geraldine said we allowed other people to define it for us, but I think in many cases that was women defining it in very narrow terms as much as men.
But.
Exactly.
I'm not a feminist.
Exactly.
But.
So that's, you know, so there was this second wave of feminists with the baby boomers and, you know, the Gloria Steinem era, and they were much more willing to embrace the term. I mean, they had sort of coined it or popularized it in a way. And then these other generations came along and were very wary of it. But I think an interesting thing has happened with social media, where it's completely embraced and it's been hashtagged and sort of branded, and it's really been sort of reclaimed in almost an overwhelming way in certain ways. So I think it's one of these things that comes and goes, and takes the contours change and the dynamics change over time, you know.
Yeah, which might be the sign of a vibrant and vigorous movement, that it's able to change over time. Nicole, what do you think?
I think it's not dirty to a point. And I think that point is based on two things. I think one, again, it's very confrontational, because we like to believe that we live in this world where everything, where there's innovation and everyone's equal. And so in that sense, you know, that there is inequality. In that sense, it's quite confrontational. But I think it's not dirty to the point where women have self-determination. And I think that's where it becomes uncomfortable, where feminism becomes dirty, is where women don't need men and we have autonomy and self-determination over our own identity and space. And I think it's you know, feminism is all well and good when everyone can retweet that hashtag, but when, as women, we say, actually, we want to define ourselves and have autonomy over our rights and our future and have ownership over our space, which... you know, which is exclusive to women and people who identify as female, I think that's when it becomes dirty, because then people start throwing out the things, well, then that's not humanist and aren't we all equal? So I think it comes to this point about when do we get to be objective and don't relate back to male power.
Do we want it to become a clean word ever? Would that be a good thing? A nice, clean, peachy, keen kind of feminism.
They're dirty and clean, this binary.
Like, is that what we want? I want young women to embrace it, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it used to drive me crazy when young women would say, I'm not a feminist, but, and then they would go and express very feminist views. So I want to strip away all those meanings that were placed on it.
I think one of the reasons it's dirty and it would be good if it got cleaned up is women's own guilt or contradictions within themselves about saying, I'm a feminist. So, you know, I'm a feminist, but, you know, my husband, when he goes to work in the morning, doesn't say to me, now, you know where the baby food is, right? You know you've got... you know, this is here, and nothing's checked, right? When I go to work, okay, it's there. There's something written that when it's not, when things aren't even balanced in your own life, I think that creates something complicated within yourself too, that makes that word tricky.
What do you think, Megan?
You know, it's been really fascinating to watch just the range of women who are claiming the term. I mean, one thing that happened, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Sarah Palin, who's the politician that we have in the States.
She can see Russia from her house.
Yeah, well, you know what, though? Tina Fey, I will defend Sarah Palin for a nanosecond here, because it was actually Tina Fey that said that, and this is just like the runaway train that is the media and social media. So I don't think, it's so funny the way like that Tina Fey and Sarah Palin just became the same person. But, you know, Sarah Palin calls her self a feminist, and I actually, you know, one time I wrote a column saying, you know what, she's allowed to call herself a feminist, and until more of these you know, other young women start using the term themselves, this is what's going to happen. It's sort of like, shame on you. Shame on you guys who are the quote-unquote real feminists, if you want to put it in those terms. You can't just, you know, refuse to use the word and then get upset when somebody else uses it who you don't, you know, agree with, or, you know, you don't agree with her politics. And I mean, I think that, you know, to me, it's a very broad term. It means you know, you get out of bed every morning, you know, you are a self-respecting person and you believe that men and women have equal rights. I think Sarah Palin does believe those things.
Yeah.
So I think she was actually allowed to use the word, but it just becomes so fraught when people get really possessive over who's allowed to use it.
I hate those fights about, are you a real feminist? Not a real feminist. Feminist fail.
Do you think Elizabeth the First was a feminist? You've spent a lot of time.
She
thinking.
Wouldn't have called herself a feminist. She wouldn't have known what the word meant.
No, but do you think she was one?
She was certainly determined to live life in her own terms, which is why she chose never to have children. And in fact, never to have sex, because that was the only way you could choose never to have children back then. So I think, yes, in a way, she was a nascent feminist. She was not a fan of women as a kind of gender, though she was personally very close to her ladies-in-waiting and had great and very affectionate relationships with them. So I think she was complex. And nowadays, I think she would have been outspoken about it, but not then. I like the idea of Sarah Palin being a feminist, because I've always thought that feminism is a broad church. And, you know, as long as you believe in equality and reproductive rights, that's the only thing I would say is like the baseline is, how do you define yourself as a feminist if you think, but I have the right to decide what another woman can do with her body?
A lot of these women, you know, women in politics in the States are completely in favor of reproductive rights, but you're not allowed to say so. I mean, you know, Laura Bush is pro-choice.
And, Condoleezza Rice as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nicole, what do you think about whether we want clean feminism, nice, peachy keen?
No, keep it dirty.
Yeah, I'm with you.
No, I want feminism to be dirty forever. I just want everybody else to get dirty.
Yeah.
You know, like, what is clean? Like, who gets to define that? And if then feminism is this thing about becoming acceptable or, you know, assimilating, then no. Not dirty all the way.
I mean, it's a movement about changing, taking power away from people. It's never going to be popular with the people that it's challenging. That's kind of its job, I would have thought, not to be popular with the powerful. Mm. It's a disruptive movement. That's its point. Let's go to another question. Ah, this is actually carries on quite nicely from where we're at. Can and should men be called feminists, or should feminist sympathising men be named separately? Nikai, what do you think?
Well, if they identify as feminists, I'd be like, take your fedora and walk out the door, good sir. the internet people get that. No, men can't be feminists. Mm-hmm. They aren't, because as feminism, it's about having self-determination over our own space. It's not just about gender equality, because then that falls into this paradigm that is defined by men. Mm. And for me, that sits very much alongside my, like, being an Aboriginal woman, and so my identity as being a black person. So in terms of that, men can't be feminists because they don't have that lived experience. Feminism is defined by womanhood, but they'd be entering a space where they had more power. You know, so it's, for me, it's about having that space to create something new. Mm. So I think men can be allies, but can men be feminists? I think it's oppressive.
Okay.
I think we definitely need a word for those guys, and that word should be men.
Tragically, as yet, I'm not sure it is, but yes, I take your point completely.
But what about all those feminist guys who use their feminism to seduce feminists? there's always that guy in college who's like, you know, so in tune with the feminist plight, and it's going to get you right in bed with that, you know. Like, so what about them?
Don't marry them. Yeah. Mm.
But don't marry a non-feminist guy either.
Yeah, no, I'm until we've got a really good word, I think I'm going to still use it for blokes who believe in and speak up for and act on issues of women's equality. I haven't got another word to describe what I'm trying to do as a mother of sons, except raise feminist sons. So I'm going to keep it. I'll be very willing to switch it out when we've got a good word.
Yeah, I'm with you because I'm going to be grandmother in April of a boy, which is a new experience for me and my family. We're all girls. And I feel exactly the same, that I want him to be a feminist, and which probably means he'll rebel and won't be, but that's okay.
I mean, it's not like saying... So I can't, obviously I can't be an Aboriginal woman, but I can be an anti-racist.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think what the analogy would be. Yeah. I'm sitting here like, is there another word that is used to describe being a proponent of rights of a group without necessarily being a member of that group?
Well, I thought the word was ally.
Well, that's what I mean, but it's right. But so it's interesting that it's never come up.
The dictionary definition of feminism is someone who believes in equal rights for women. So that is not a gender-specific term or definition.
But equal rights is very gendered, because this idea of equality is very much made about... It has a history of being made by men. And so this idea of then equal rights about women, it sometimes feels like, for me, to then, you know, this idea of success, of what it is to be an equal woman, is to actually just become a white man. So for me, this idea of feminism sits outside of that. It gives me freedom to then construct my identity. So then having a man who identifies as a feminist, for me, imposes on that, because there's a level of privilege they have that I don't.
It's a very interesting debate.
Interesting. Yeah. I know. I've never had that question asked. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
I know Dale Spend, a very well-known Australian feminist, does not believe that men can be feminists either. Mm. So it's definitely an open question. I'm in two minds, but having the grandson thing has changed me a little. Funny how that happens. Well, in fact, you've just led me beautifully into the next question. Thank you so much.
As long as you don't ask me first.
Okay.
I think you're about to be.
All right, you gave me the segue, so you don't have to answer first. I'll go to Megan for this one. We're discussing feminism here. I've given the dictionary definition. Geraldine gave a definition earlier. But what is feminism? What is it in essence?
This is the festival of unanswerable questions.
It is.
As far as that
it
I
is.
Have noticed.
That's
so
right.
I think we are right in keeping. That question is right in keeping. What is a feminist? I mean...
No. What is feminism?
What is feminism?
Which I think is a different thing from what is a feminist.
Well, I mean, I hate to answer like it's we all define it our own ways. I mean, that's a cop-out as an answer, but at the same time, I guess I don't want to speak for others, so I would say... Feminism is believing that men and women have equal rights and, you know, are entitled to the
equal
same
value
things.
And equal.
But you know, at the same time, there are so many nuances and there's so many, you know, it's a very general description that doesn't factor in all sorts of, you know, dynamics and class dynamics and race dynamics and all sorts of things. So I think it's really hard to answer that in you know, 10 words or less.
Sally, do you have a definition?
Well, it's just, yeah, it's really hard to think of an answer that isn't sanctimonious to you, that just isn't sort of, doesn't sound...
I'll go for it.
Go.
Yeah, go on. What's wrong with being sanctimonious?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to each person there's it's an obvious sort of answer and I have twins, right? Baby boy, baby girl. They're 8.5 months old. And I want to know why I worry about my daughter more already. Mm. All right? So to me, the answer to that question is in that next question. Mm. To me, that I shouldn't... It kills me that this is inside me. Mm. They're 8.5 months old. But I know she's going to have to work harder and be better and probably be paid less than my son.
Mm. I think that's a very interesting answer. Megan.
But, you know, I'm thinking here, so I wonder if it's helpful to think, like, what does patriotism mean, for instance?
Yeah.
Okay, so
not much here, Megan.
Okay, sorry. I'm going to be the token. I know. You guys are more evolved. But no, like, patriotism could mean thinking that your country is better than other countries,
yeah.
Or it could mean caring about your country in such a way that you're going to have a global perspective, that you're going to be compassionate, that you're going to be humanist, all these things. I mean, it's just so hard to speak in these enormously general terms.
I have a little definition that I use for what it's worth, mm-hmm. which is a simple one, and that is that feminism is a point of view that puts a woman at the center of her own life rather than at the periphery of someone else's. That's how I see it. And that means you notice when women are left out, when they're excluded, when they're treated as a kind of ancillary.
The periphery of someone else's, and that someone else being a man.
Well, it could be a child.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
but then there's, there's a whole, you know, in the motherhood, you know, the sort of.
We're all on the periphery of other people's lives,
right?
By definition,
yes.
But it's a point of view that actually notices the woman rather than just seeing her as always an ancillary
or a vessel,
a vessel.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's my little working definition. What do you think?
I kind of went into then, like, what isn't feminism? And I think it's, well, I think feminism for myself is having ownership of my womanhood. It's having ownership of not having to, you know, exist within this relationship with males. I have a boyfriend. I exist in a relationship with males all the time. What am I doing? And a father and a brother. But, not all men. For me, feminism is where I have autonomy to define my identity that doesn't exist within a patriarchy. I feel like I'm talking in like these big generalist terms, but it's this idea of that not being a factor in how do I get self-determination away from that power relationship.
So then what do you do with the sort of, you know, sensibility that's sort of like, I'm a very pro-sex feminist, I am a stripper, I'm a feminist sex worker for men, I'm a stripper. I mean, that is a whole thing that has come about around feminism. And, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying, I really don't have a strong opinion one way or the other, but it's, I think it has muddied the waters in a lot of people's minds and become confusing.
This is where I think we go, what isn't feminism?
Right, I know.
As opposed to going, what is? Because then if we go, what isn't feminism? We're then looking at all these marginalized groups, and quite usually we have one common denominator, which is, in this case, like patriarchy, where it's based on supremacy. So I think if we're looking at this idea of what is feminism, where, you know, where there is, on the basis of equality, marginalization, I think it's a lot more, for me, I don't know, I wonder if then is it better than to focus on what sits at the centre that marginalises us? Mm. Which then goes against what I was saying about having our own space. But think
about
this.
The margin and the space.
And I shall tweet.
Yes. A very wide margin. Yes.
There's space within the margin.
Yeah. I think that there's also something about the recognition of inequality. So I get a lot of sticks sometimes from usually male reviewers saying, oh, you know, she's writing about the 17th century, but her female characters are all feminists and that's ahistoric. Bullshit, actually. Yeah. Go read some court records where women are hauled into court and there's verbatim transcripts, which is where that's often the only place you can hear the unheard, where you can hear enslaved people speaking for themselves, where you can hear women who weren't allowed to be literate. And they've been hauled into court for crimes such as, in the New England church courts, a big one was being a scold.
And she's not have been in prison constantly.
Well, all of us, right? Because here's what you had to do to be a scold. You had to be overheard criticising a man in public. Take me away.
Sort of the opposite of the Bechdel test.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But so, and you hear these women and they are furious. Mm. They are completely ropeable and they are very eloquently expressing the injustice of their predicament in what I recognise as feminist terms. And I think it's almost cocky that we think, you know, that we invented this in 1960 or whenever.
Go on, Sally.
Or that we just own it in overly privileged societies, of course. Mm. Women in so many parts of the world
that are just sort of homogenised into one oppressed mass that don't even have time to contemplate such things. Well, yes, they do.
Mm. Yeah.
In fact, your question about Elizabeth I, you reminded me when you talked about the courts, there was a book written in 14-something called City of the Ladies, and it was a fantasy by a female writer called Christine de Pisan of a city built by women, designed by women, built by women, for women to shut out men. And tapestries were made of the illuminations. And Elizabeth I owned those tapestries. Mary, Queen of Scots, owned those tapestries. Catherine de' Medici owned those tapestries. So the feminist urge to keep some distance, some space, a margin existed a long, long time ago.
Well, it did within. So in Sydney, so when, you know, the tall ships came over, there was, are you guys all familiar with Bennelong? Mm. So Bennelong was the first kind of, I called him like the first.
Megan may not be.
No, tell me who that is.
Like he was the interlocutor. What's that word?
Interlocutor. It's like, so hard to say.
You know, the in-between between the Aboriginal people in Sydney and the tall ships. And he, you know, ended up going over to the UK and whatnot. This is a rather simplified version. But he had this, his wife was a woman called Barangaroo. And so, and she just, like, she was not cool with these people coming, and she knew these white people were trouble, and she was like, mm-mm-mm. Anyway, they had this dinner where they invited Ben along, and they said, look, you have to put some clothes on your wife, right? You have to dress her up. She needs to be acceptable for this dinner. So she agreed, and she played smiles and pretended she didn't quite understand, and she was going to wear these clothes. They dressed her up. Come the dinner, she took off all her clothes, put a bone in her nose and rocked up to this dinner as like this, you know, like as if to be like, screw you guys, screw the white male patriarchy, yeah, go back to the UK. I think that's like, that's feminism. Like she was like one of the first feminisms, and that's really cool.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So but what happened then?
Oh, well then, it's actually, like this is very, like this is such a like a simple, you know, summarising of it. It was this really, it was like a love triangle. Because there was another guy, I forget his name, it's terrible, don't tell my dad. So he went over to, he kind of got taken over to the UK as like a, he had no choice about it. And so whilst he was away, Barangaroo married his best mate, who was actually a real, you know, after seeing what happened then to Bennelong, was quite the radical who ended up being killed. And then when he came back, he saw, like, you know, the whole power dynamic of the tribe had shifted. And that was the beginnings of Aboriginal and white people politics in Sydney. Mm-hmm. But it's quite a love story. I think it'd make, like, a great miniseries.
Yeah.
Like
an
Aboriginal telenovela.
Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sounds good. Somebody in the audience should pick that up.
Yeah, please.
So what's another question on my copious list here. Oh, it actually, there's one here that goes back to what you were talking about young women saying, I'm not a feminist, but why do women refuse to be feminists? What is going on in their mind? What is behind that urge to distance themselves from the identity of feminism?
Stockholm syndrome.
Well, you make a strong point, though. It's placating the powerful.
Yeah,
it's a scary place to disrupt them.
Yeah, you know, I've been living in the States and had a high school age son who's just gone off to uni now, but I was very worried about a lot of the young women at the school. There's a tremendous amount of cutting and anorexia and all this pathology around being a young woman in the culture that I'm angry at myself that I didn't know more about it until I was confronted directly with it. But you must see some of that.
Yeah, I mean, so much of, again, so there are so many sort of class nuances to that sort of, you know, phenomenon as well.
Well, I mean, this is a pretty working class.
Really?
Yeah. The year-round community is not the summer community. Yeah.
Oh, you're and talking a lot about of, where you are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think that there is a generation of women. It may be my, so I'm like considered Generation X. I think that there's a current among the women in our generation that sort of rebelled against their own mothers, who were sort of second wave feminists, and you know, I know some families where the mother and sometimes the father tried so hard to raise the children as, you know, not conforming to stereotypes and assumptions, yeah. and that sort of effort became so oppressive that you know, the daughters sometimes went the other way, and there was an anger at their mothers. I mean, you know, I actually have a whole theory, and I'm perfectly happy to be talked out of this, but you know, the sort of intense culture of motherhood and parenthood and the helicopter parenting and the obsessive parenting, I think in my generation is often a reaction against the latchkey kid syndrome. That's what they called it back in the 70s and 80s, with that first generation of mothers going to work. Some of those daughters are still really angry about that. Yeah. And so they are sticking it to their mothers by saying, well, you know, I'm going to be home. I'm going to be here 300% of the time for my kids, and I'm going to do everything for them. I mean, you can't win. These things are always shifting back and forth. So I think there's a lot going on. And saying I'm not a feminist is also sort of a way of saying, hey, don't worry, I shave under my arms. Don't, you know, don't get me wrong. But I'm still going to be... It's desirable.
It's also the optimism of youth. And yes. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to have that knocked out of people either, that you're brought up, you can do whatever you want, you can be whatever you can be, and, you know, whether or not you believe that or wrestle with it, when you're young, you know, you want to hope that your turn's going to be better than all this stuff you're hearing. Mm-hmm. And it's not until you get older, I think, that these sort of blows come one by one, where where you realise, that's what they're talking about. But I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing either. That optimism of being young.
How does that mix, though, with the idea of, and I mean, I don't think it's just an American phenomenon. It's certainly something I think we'd agree that this self-harming, anorexia, eating disorders, a generation of what appears to be very stressed young women in particular. So how does the optimism of youth, which I get, I completely understand what you're saying and agree with it, but then there's this terrible darkness around young women too at the moment.
Are you talking about the optimism of being like a 10-year-old girl? Yes. Which is just that sort of moment of exuberance.
Although I also agree that 10-year-old girls can be absolutely miserable.
Right. If they're precocious.
As well. And I mean, I suppose it's a more, it's a broader generational thing that I'm talking about. But you can also have a kind of optimism about political issues and still be miserable too.
Yes. I think that's right. I think human beings can carry two completely contradictory ideas. In fact, maybe how we define human beings, that they have two completely contradictory ideas.
Well, if you only had two, you'd be really winning,
you'd be
right?
You'd be simple, really. Yeah, it'd be easy. Absolutely true. What do you think about why women resist the name of feminism? And I do think it's more predominant in young women, but it's also, I think, something that women sometimes in different classes from different ethnic backgrounds also have more difficulty with the term feminism.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons. I think that they've all been brought up. Desirability, I think, is a big part of it. You know, one of the worst things you could possibly be in this world is, you know, not a sexual object. you know, like so many...
That's power, so often.
Wait till you're 59. Yeah. You're so not one.
Yeah, but the way we're described, you know, is so much about, you know, our desirability and things like that. And it's, you know, when you say you're a feminist, that can be quite scary. I also think it has something to do with this idea of what success is and realising you can't ever be a part of it. When I, after doing my show, whilst doing my show, Black Comedy, it was the first time I ever, you know, was on television and things like that. And I thought back to this time when I was a little girl and I was this kind of, I was 15. This wasn't that little, really. But I was, you know, the Aboriginal girl at school. I was loud and, you know, chubby, and I remember, and all I wanted to do was be like an actress, right? And I remember looking at my skin colour and, you know, looking at, you know, the Cleo and Dolly and all of that type of stuff, and just crying myself to sleep because I thought I'm never going to get to that. Like, I'm just, that's not like, I don't fit into that world. That is not what success is. So I think this idea of I'm not a feminist, but also plays into this idea of what success is and who are the people who make it and that optimism. And I think what you do is you go, I have to be like what that is to have the life I want. And that is so niche. It's so niche. It's so small. You know, it's for the very few. So I think this idea of success and making it and having all your dreams come true, that only ever happens to, well, it doesn't, but this idea of it is, you know, is based on this idea of privilege. So I think maybe it's to do with this, to do with success. I mean, for me, I once got caught, someone called me a fat black slut in the comments of an article I wrote, and I thought, isn't that great? Like, I've really made it, because yeah, I'm never like, what's the opposite of a fat black slut? Like a, you know, prudish white man, slim yeah. white man, yeah. and I'm never going to be that. And once, you know, you realise that that idea of success is not for you, but there's a whole other world out there, then yeah, that's when I started embracing my feminism, I think. But before that, you know, it was like, oh, I'm not a feminist, but, and I'm Aboriginal, but, and, you know, so it was all about narrowing my identity to fit in.
So you're really giving us another definition of feminism in that answer by saying that it is refusing to be defined by the way other people see you,
yes.
but deciding to define yourself for yourself.
Yes.
That's really interesting. It takes us to, I mean, this is also questions of work, love and feminism, and we've talked a lot about feminism, but there are some questions here, particularly about love, which is kind of interesting. There's a very profound question, and I'd be very interested in your answers. Why does a part of us want to destroy what we love? You were talking, Megan, about the wanting to stick one up your mother because she, you know, brought...
I didn't use that term precisely. Stick it to.
Okay. You can back away from that if you want to.
I'm just vamping to get more time so I can think of an answer to whatever this question is going to be.
Okay. You were talking about, though, that reaction to the way you're parented and wanting yeah. to do the opposite of whatever it was that you see your parents as failing to have done. And so, I mean, it is inevitable when you parent that you will fail to parent.
Right.
So what is it? What stops us from loving unconditionally, from, you know, being the kinds of things that I think mothers, the ideal, the stereotype of the mother is meant to be?
Well, I think what stops us is our inherent limitations as humans. This idea of unconditional love, there's so much sentimentality around that, and it's become part of the kind of cultural discourse. If you love someone deeply, you must love them unconditionally. I don't believe in that concept, actually. I think, with the exception of a mother and an infant, perhaps, unconditional love to me just seems really disingenuous and perhaps unhealthy. I mean, even, you know, you can love somebody deeply, but at some point, if they're terrible to you in 500 ways, loving them unconditionally isn't doing anybody any favors. But I think there's all these kinds of concepts floating around the culture that we're just asked to accept
yeah.
and to embrace. And that becomes a real tyranny.
And to feel guilty
yeah,
if we fail
and we deny ourselves our authentic feelings and responses to things. And so there's so much baggage around what it means to be a mother or a parent, the whole notion of family. I mean, it's really like, I think that it's worth kind of examining what that means and without guilt. I mean, it's really a taboo to say, I don't want to have children. It's also, I mean, it's talk about unspeakable. I mean, to say, actually, I don't want to be in a family. I mean, think about that. What if someone was to say, well, you know what? I'm defining family by my friends, my community, all sorts of, you know, other types of, you know, ways that humans can be together. But these things just never get discussed because we're so invested in these ideas around unconditional love and traditional family.
That constant failure or human failure, not being able to love everyone you love unconditionally all the time, is a really different thing, though, to wanting to, this idea of wanting to destroy the thing you love, which there's nothing I love I want to destroy. There's something in the mother. I mean, I'm a bit obsessed with this at the moment, I guess. But in this idea that if the idea of the mother loving the child is, you know, the great pure, the most pure kind of love we all give it as an example.
I said a very human, small child.
Yes.
Only up to a certain... There's, I'd say, like a weight cutoff.
Like 6... it's 9 kilos, right? Yeah. We perhaps strive for that love for the rest of our lives as adults, and perhaps men look for that in a different way to women, of that what you get from... if you're fortunate enough to have a loving mother, not everyone does, but we probably get luckier at that strike rate than, you know, husbands or, you know, other common relationships. That, you know, do we spend the rest of our adult lives looking for somebody that will love us as much as our mother? And if we do, in some way, do boys and men do that differently to girls and women?
And do heterosexual boys and men do that differently?
Exactly.
I'm just thinking.
Because you're just never going to get that again.
Right. So our kind of default setting is unconditional love. This concept of unconditional love that exists for a very limited and prescribed period of time.
And may not even ever actually exist, because I have to say that I'm not sure I loved my daughters, even when they were really small.
Okay, people are
gonna be
tweeting this.
When they woke me at 4 a.m. and kept me awake for hours screaming. I think there were moments in there where I did think to myself the most horrible of all thoughts, which was, why the fuck did I ever have you? And so I wonder if that fantasy of the unconditional love is something we strive for that we've actually never had.
It's a fantasy. I think that might be the key word.
I think you get it from the kid is where you get it until they turn 5.
That's a really interesting observation, that it's actually the unconditional love of the child for the parent.
Oh.
And I think that's proven, isn't it, in the way children love even very abusive, very negative parents. And maybe that's what we're looking for.
It's also about the same age where they really discover the strength of the word I, you know, and become much more self-centred, isn't it, off in the world.
Yeah. But I'm worried about the questioner, actually, frankly. I think that questioner needs to seek help, because I don't know about destroying the thing you love. I don't feel like that is a thing.
Yeah, I think maybe it's destroying certain toxic aspects of that relationship, which exist in all sorts of relationships. So, yeah, I don't know if it's destroying the actual...
Well, object. I mean, I think you could say, though, that, I mean, we've just spent a week in Australia, which was about domestic violence, where we watched a number of programs, or I certainly did, Hitting Home and Call Me Dad, which was clearly about people who were actively appearing to destroy something that they claimed to love.
But they didn't love.
I mean, I've always believed that love's an action, not a feeling.
Yeah.
It's how you act, not how you feel. But if what you're feeling is one thing and what you're doing is another, then it can be seen as that complicated destroy. And maybe it's the destroying of a weakness.
Or
love seen as a weakness, therefore if I love you, that's a weakness. I'm a vulnerability. I have to destroy
that. Well, I hate myself so much that anybody who would want to be with me, I hate.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you're enmeshed enough and you're actually destroying, by destroying somebody else, you're destroying yourself.
Yes.
So
I've often thought that's what's really going on in those very, very violent relationships. It's a projection of weakness onto the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's so complicated.
Oh,
I know. You know,
I'm only guessing. I wouldn't know.
Everybody,
But it's a very profound and interesting question to think about, and leads us into a whole lot of areas about what is love and what is unconditional love and how... And I really like your observation that actually probably the only moment you get it is from a child or possibly a dog.
Dog, absolutely. Even after they're five.
Especially, yes. Not a puppy, not a puppy. Yeah. Oh, my
certainly,
God.
I'm a cat person. You don't get unconditional love from a cat.
That's a very sophisticated relationship.
Oh, it's very, very. It's of equals. Yeah. Well, possibly superior in staff.
That's S&M. More
What do you think, Nikai?
Oh, I don't know. Look, I feel very, you know, what's the word? Sheltered right now. I mean, I have like a stepdog. That's the extent of my, you know, mother experience. And we don't even like each other. He looked me in the eye as he took a wee on my suitcase the other day. And I was like, you know this is wrong.
But Izzy's like, you're not my real owner.
That's right.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I'm not your real mother. Yeah. So, I wonder though, if destroy what you love, like if what is love, and I think, you know, if it's possibly looking at it, I guess, taking it outside of that type of, you know, loving another person, or is a journey of introspection. If we do those things to then have questions to ask, you know, if there's a way forward for innovation, if you love and you're content, do you ever really evolve? So maybe it's something to do
so
with
that.
So
we set up booby traps for ourselves to keep ourselves kind of moving forward. Well, I mean, I think there is, we call it commitment phobia, don't we? This refusal to actually, the fear of love, the fear of being sucked into a kind of soft, gooey love situation
losing
that
ourselves.
Will swallow us up. Yeah, the losing ourselves.
But that, I think, goes to this tyranny of choices thing that we have going on in the culture. I mean, so much of commitment phobia comes out of this compulsion to keep looking for the next thing. And actually, interestingly, it kind of ties back into some of the discussion around feminism, because this idea of choice and that you can have everything, that I think is another reason that some young generations of women kind of push back against that. I mean, you know, it's really interesting when I was putting together this book of writers talking about making the decision not to have the kids. Counterintuitively, it was the people from the sort of second wave feminism, that era, that were much less apologetic about that choice than, say, the younger women in particular, because, you know, the Gloria Steinem era, Gloria Steinem was totally unapologetic about not wanting children. Now we are in the Sheryl Sandberg era, you know, lean in, choose everything. It's not choose what you want. It's now choose everything.
Yeah.
And that is an incredible burden to bear, I think. And it ties back into all of these things. It's what makes us commitment phobic. It's what makes us unhappy, because we think that if we're unhappy, we must have chosen the wrong thing.
It's all our fault.
Just chemical or the way of life. Or, you know.
It might also explain some of the pressure on young women that leads to self-harm, to anorexia. The idea, this idea, which is in a way an oppressive idea, you can be anything you want.
And you can control it somehow.
Yeah.
In the wrong, you know.
And it's your fault if you're not.
But also think we're so programmed into thinking we're not deserving of love or of happiness or of, like, we get all these choices. So you set your life out to go get it, but then you also have this really deep ingrained psyche that you're not worthy of that your existence is somehow subservient. I don't know. It just makes me think of the Kardashians. And
of course, I was going there too. Yeah.
But, like, I used to follow them on Instagram, right? And I had to stop doing it because I realised that I was, the more I looked at, you know, this idea, like the myth of the Kardashians and their Instagram posts, I was also looking up, like, nose jobs. You know, like, what is the price of lip injections and those types of things? Oh. It was just so, like, I didn't even realise I was doing it. This idea of okay, so we're told we can do everything, be everything. You know, this is, you know, these ideas of success that are so like popular within our pop culture. But then on the other side of it, the counter of that is that you're not them and you're not worthy. So I don't know. Maybe
you're not perfect.
Yeah,
I think that the focus should be more on figuring out what success means to you, being able to set, you know, define that, and having that be sort of more encouraged. You know,
Guys, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think you really nailed it with this tyranny of the Sheryl Sandberg idea. She is very similar to the Kardashians in so many ways.
Wow, that is probably a statement that has never been uttered.
And boy, would she hate to hear that.
Yeah, I don't. The Kardashians would be like, who?
But, you know, I think that, you know, when I was coming up, I remember this conversation very vividly. I was a cadet reporter on the Sydney Morning Herald, and one of the senior reporters, my first job was in the sports department, which was just a fiesta of sexual harassment. I was the only woman in that department, and these guys were just unstoppable. But there was this quite nice older guy who didn't pinch my bum, and, you know, he took a promotion to be editor, even though what he loved doing more than anything was covering the track. He loved to go to the races. He knew all about it. It was great passion of his life. He had, you could say, the perfect job. And then they offered him a promotion, and he took it. And I thought, why would you do that? Because at that point, I think, you know, we had, the door had opened enough to let women into the workforce, but it hadn't closed in on you enough to stop you making the choices that made you happy. And I couldn't imagine ever taking a job as an editor because I was a journalist, because I wanted to be out and about and doing new things all the time, not sitting in an office, you know, trying to fix other people's work. Mm.
So it's this idea of the compulsion to climb the ladder, that success is defined as who wins at the end. Who, lying in the graveyard, had the most money, the biggest title and the biggest office?
And is sort of the big dickus.
The biggest dickus, yeah.
Lean in and be prepared for exhaustion. Yeah.
You know, lean in and then fall over.
Are women more tired than men?
I think everybody's really tired.
I think everybody's really tired.
I think we're all leaning over in a way, you know.
I think, but tiredness, this is something that I'm really, really interested in, possibly because I spend a lot of time very tired. But I do think that the corollary of this idea that unless you're actually striving to get somewhere, wherever that somewhere might be, this what is success for you, you're somehow failing, is producing this absolute storm of exhaustion. I mean, I read somewhere, I can't even remember where it was, that Sydney outflows, you know, the sewage and stuff, is absolutely full of chemicals from antidepressants and vitamins.
Yeah, the water's sad.
Yeah.
It is. The
no,
water
the fish are really,
sad.
Really happy.
The water should be totally focused and productive.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Adderall in the water.
Maybe it's not just the water, it's actually our shit that is full of antidepressants and vitamins. So basically what that means is people are medicating to keep up with this relentless expectation, which is coming from where? Is it from us? Is it from outside? Is it a combination of both? What is this expectation we're all trying to live up to?
Housing prices might have something to do with it.
Yeah. I wonder, too, if just increased communication, being able to see more people, more lifestyles, more options. I mean, you know, we have it now with social media. And, I mean, this is a very obvious reductive thing to say, but you look at Facebook and all it is people, you know, showing, you know, this, you know, quite carefully curated versions of their lives. And we all get duped into thinking that that little moment in time is their entire life. But even, you know, 50 years ago with television, I'm sure the exact same thing was happening. Suddenly you're looking at commercials and television shows and seeing a whole bunch of stuff to be jealous about that was
or to feel
not in, as in
to
your
feel
face.
Inadequate about.
Right, exactly.
I often wonder, it's not necessarily that you desire it, but that you feel inadequate because you haven't got it.
Right, and I think if you're seeing a very limited view of it on television, for instance, that is a different experience than going into some rich person's house and feeling envious or inadequate or whatever it is, but at the same time having an interaction with that person and seeing that they're human, knowing something about their marriage perhaps, that it's not so great, you know, seeing that they've got, you know, dirty socks over there or
something
like that.
And just quietly hating them, you know.
Yes, yes.
Which is always fun.
Hating them, right. That's such an underrated activity, isn't
it,
really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can recommend it. What do you think, Sally?
Well, I really agree with what just said. I probably don't have a lot more to add to it, actually. Okay.
Didn't you just post something incredibly fabulous about yourself, though, on Facebook probably this morning?
I don't do social media.
Oh. You are a healthy, mentally healthy
I don't
paragon
do any. I don't
of mental
do
health.
Facebook, never have. I
so
don't
I'm going to just have to quietly
I do hack
now.
My husband's Twitter account to, so that I can
you're a stalker.
Look in, yeah. But no, God, no. No. I mean, that part of that is just, it's part of life management, isn't it? What's got to go? What has to go?
Yeah, with 8.5-month-old twins, I can understand
it. Way before then. I've never done it. I wrestle a little bit with, oh, God, what am I missing out on? Twitter, not for long.
But they tell you for your career that you have to do it.
Well, that might explain a few things.
Why are the Kardashians succeeding if not for their prolific, Instagram?
Something for me to do instead of summer reading.
Right, yeah.
I got on there in order to make sure my teenagers weren't posting anything inappropriate, and then they sensibly closed down their accounts and got on with living, and now I'm completely, it's scrapbook time.
I'm completely hooked to social media. I absolutely love it. So, I'm a junkie. I even play Hearts, so apparently now I'm a gamer.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm just so cool. What about you? Is social media... Well, you gave up the Kardashians, which I'm pleased to hear.
Well, it just makes me think of doomsday preppers. So doomsday preppers, people who prepare for the apocalypse or the end of the world, those numbers have risen significantly in the last few years. And I wonder if it's this idea of this of constantly striving for success. So something is related to prepping in terms of how safe do we feel in this world and how safe do we feel in this society. And I do feel like, there is, with the constant news cycle, there's a real, kind of fear culture. So this idea of striving towards success or to having lots or to, somehow being... not being fallible to what possibly happens when things go wrong. I think maybe it's a mechanism for safety.
That makes a lot of sense, that we're accumulating things to protect us when the apocalypse occurs. Yeah. I think that makes an enormous amount of sense. I hadn't thought about it before.
And all the cheap crap we're accumulating is hastening the apocalypse.
Exactly. How we destroy the thing we love.
Unless you're a prepper. There it is. epiphany time.
Excellent interlocution.
Thank you very much. I'm
excellent
learning.
Excellent pronunciation.
Yeah.
I've learned in the course of this discussion. Yeah.
We're now getting to the point, I think, where we can throw the questions open to the floor. Now, there are microphones, and I would ask you to wait till you have the microphone in your hand before you ask a question. So, who has a question? There's quite a few at the front here. We do like questions from the back as well.
Hi. I was just wondering whether you felt that society will ever reach a point at which it can transcend the patriarchal inclination to define women in accordance with their fertility and sexual desirability.
Who are you asking? All of us?
Yeah. Panel?
No.
I think as somebody who just turned 60 and is technically now in the wonderful realm I've been dying to get to, which is the crone, I think it's time to embrace cronedom and to say that this is probably the most exciting time of a woman's life because your responsibilities to others are now much more manageable and yet you still got, and maybe as a result of that, a lot of energy to, and you don't care anymore. And that's so fantastically liberating. So bring on the crones, I say.
I couldn't agree with you more. It is so wonderful. People, this thing about getting older and women should dread it and menopause and all of that. I'm sorry, not having periods anymore. What precisely is there a downside to that? I can't, I've never been able to work it out. It's wonderful. Your joy time will come. And you won't give a shit that the guys don't think you're attractive. And it's your turn, so just wait.
Hi. I was thinking about what Sally said about you go along with the optimism of youth until you hit a point where you go, oh, that's what they were talking about, and what, and the journey that you're on. And thinking, why be good? The title hooked me in because I thought if you're a good girl, you get invited to a lot of the patriarchy. You get quite a long way, maybe even 80% of the way before you're... get your first hitch. So I'm wondering, how did you women, or crone-elect, find the balance between being good and having to abandon being good in order to keep growing?
Question.
Who wants to take that one first?
I guess I figured it out through writing. I mean, I still, you know, as an opinion columnist, especially as, like, you know, the chick opinion columnist on the page, sort of. I guess I'm the only woman left. I think there's very few anybody left at the Los Angeles Times, actually. But I write things that make people angry. My job is to make people angry. If everyone is happy with something I wrote, I have failed that week as an opinion columnist. But, you know, I have struggled since the beginning of my writing career with this dichotomy between wanting to be an interesting writer and having thoughts and wanting to be, you know, not polarizing, but wanting to be, to suggest things that are going to get people thinking and talking. And on the other hand, wanting to be a good girl and wanting to be a nice girl, wanting to have people not mad at me, wanting to have my parents not embarrassed by what I wrote, which was an ongoing problem. One of them is dead, and it continues to be a problem. So it's really hard. I feel in a way like my writing life has, you know, not saved me, but it is the sort of outlet for that. But I don't feel that, I still feel like there's an element around which I have to sort of make up for my mean writing by being a nice person, and that's terrible.
So I should
maybe
think
I'll
so, Megan,
get away
absolutely.
From that. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have one single thick track like that. That in fact, my working life. Was the first moment I got a real knock that I thought, and when I parted ways with a certain magazine and it's all male board in a very, very, very nasty public stoush some years ago, where I felt something I hadn't felt before, and I felt that if there'd been at least one other woman involved somehow in that story, it would have been different. And it was absolutely gobsmacking to me, that whole experience. Absolutely. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe how nasty it was, and so on. So up until that point in my life, I think I felt work was an outlet as well. So sometimes it's and it came as such a shock to me, that experience, I think blows can happen where you just, oh my God, the world is not the way I thought. This is not the way I, you know, and of course you do that and you question your reality of everything. It can happen with a relationship or having children or the death of a parent or another, you know. So, yeah, I think for me it's been much more messy, my sense of it.
The rewards for the good girl.
Yeah, but also too, you know, when you talk about, you know, you've got to say things that not everyone agrees with, and I can be a bit like that sometimes, and a really good example for this conversation, and I'm putting up my armour already before I say it, is that I didn't like Julia Gillard's misogyny speech, right? The speech was great. It's in my book. But I didn't... The context... I was one of those people that I will go to my grave saying the context of that speech mattered. Mm. It really mattered. And when I said that on the radio, I felt like I had to put a shield around me of women, you know, that there was no space with women
at all for me to have that point of view. That was another, that was a moment for me too of realising, wow, you know, I can't, well, it's not okay to have a different take on this and still be a feminist.
Yeah.
Right? There was a leader, a woman. What did Julia Gillard do for women before she got ousted, before that speech? You know?
She cut the income of single mothers that day.
Yeah, she cut the income of single mothers that day. She was defending Peter Slipper making that speech. And somehow, because it was a masterful piece of oratory, I mean, it was great. And if she'd given it in a domestic violence shelter the day she became Prime Minister, it would have been one of the greatest speeches ever made. But I'm somebody that thinks the context matters. And, you know, so moments, breaks, thumping moments.
Geraldine?
No, you bummed me out because I heard it out of context.
Well, the whole world
now
did.
I have to totally
the
reconsider
whole
it.
World did, you know.
Yeah. No, I think good is a very suppressive concept, and as somebody who, you know, was raised in an Irish Catholic family and went to Catholic school, the good thing, the good girl, you know, it was big and sin and all that. Blah. And the only good things that ever came to me were from transgressing it. And so, you know, and I have to, you know, I was lucky when I grew up because transgression was sort of normative, and thank God for Wendy Bacon. You know, there she was, dressed as a nun, protesting censorship, wearing a sandwich board or holding a sign saying, "I have been fucked by God, still prick." And she was my hero. And I realized that you could be ferocious, but it didn't mean that you weren't kind. She's one of the kindest people I know. And so that duality, that you can be a kind person and still have really strong, obnoxious opinions, was very freeing for me.
Kaya?
I also think that this idea that we talk about mainstream space in terms of, you know, infiltrating the mainstream isn't actually, this idea of being good isn't actually, you know, that mainstream. So, you know, like, for instance, like, I don't think I'm particularly clever, but I, you know, when you, if you say or have a particular thought, I think, well, there's like probably like a thousand million other people having this exact same thought or have this very similar dilemma. So therefore, in terms of being a writer, my work's going to speak to those people. So my, you know, this struggle between being a good girl and a bad girl, or, you know, like fighting the patriarchy or being different, actually isn't that individual, and it's far more universal than it is different, if that makes sense. And I mean, like, when I was a little girl, I used to climb this tree out the front of my grandmother's house, and I had this little Aboriginal swimsuit, and I used to yell out, "I'm a little Koori girl, I'm a little black girl." And then I went to school, and at school I was the fat Abbo, and was called Abbo every day for like 12 years. Then I went to uni and I thought, okay, well, I'll just keep studying, you know, I'll leave these little like racist rednecks behind and I'll be fine. Then I went to uni and I got some scholarships, and it was like the first, like, she's the first Aboriginal scholar of this. And then I would have people for a week, I think I counted like 5 or 7 people who said to me, "Isn't it great you've made it this far?" And I thought, what does that mean? And I thought, it's the exact same thing as being called Abbo in the playground, and I've left that little girl who climbed the tree behind. And that's when I realised, again, and I've, you know, went on about it a lot today, but I was never going to be that good girl, and I was done with being good. And when I rejected that idea, and eventually, you know, kind of, not I completed my law degree, but kind of dropped out towards the end of there and pursued writing, that's when doors opened to me, because far more people identify with not fitting in than they do with fitting in. So I don't know, like, I wonder, you know, this idea of good is so, so narrow and unattainable, and who cares?
And they're boring. Yeah. really boring good girls. I also don't know that it's that much fun. I look at those women who I think have bought that idea that they need to be approved of to get ahead. Some conservative politicians come to mind, and they all seem to have what I call Nancy Reagan eyes. I don't know if you ever noticed Nancy Reagan.
The hair.
No, but it's the eyes. The smile goes to here, always smiling, and the eyes are terrified. And they're looking like this. Is it okay? Is it okay? Am I okay? Are the boys approving? Is it okay? Have I not transgressed? Am I okay? Am I still a good girl? Who'd want to be doing that the whole of your life? Ain't worth it. Be a bad girl. So much more fun. Now, who else has who's got the microphone?
You've defined feminism as a sense of equality, but how about an acknowledgement of specifically female characteristics or behaviours as being something other? And so I'm curious to know whether that fits in with your definition of feminism and how that fits into the whole workplace thing. We haven't talked a lot about work either.
Who wants to take that one?
I'm really afraid to say something about female characteristics and what that means. And it's such a... Why am I afraid? Well, I mean, because it's like, who are we to say what is a female characteristic? I feel like this subject lends itself to a tremendous amount of...
Tweeters.
People getting very angry on Twitter. I'll just say it. And I'm too good of a girl to one... I'm too jet-lagged to get assaulted on Twitter today. Look, I think we're in a really interesting moment, and I don't know what exactly is going on in Australia around this, but certainly in the States, there's huge discussions going on. What it does it mean to be female? What does it mean to be male? You know, these definitions are breaking down. So I think that under the umbrella of feminism, a lot of even sort of talking in those binary terms is starting to explode. So, I mean, for me, I guess I always... Part of how I define feminism is that I am a person first. And this is a very reductive thing to say, I mean, I don't particularly feel feminine when I'm really at the top of my game, when I'm writing something that's really exciting to me, when I'm being funny, for instance. I mean, I actually think that women are so discouraged from being funny that in order to use comedy or tell a joke, you have to, at least up until now, you've had to kind of strip away your femininity for a moment while you go into that realm. So
Christopher Hitchens wrote an essay on that.
Well, and I actually wrote a column when Christopher Hitchens died saying, well, you know what, let's think about it this way. Women aren't as funny because we're not allowed to be. And let's look at this from a feminist point of view. I got in so much trouble for that. I mean, they went apeshit on me because I was such an anti-feminist for saying that.
Seems to me women have suddenly become very funny. Amy Schumer, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler. I mean, it's almost like the funniest people at the moment.
Yeah, but it's also, but they have sort of been willing to step away from traditional femininity, but also using it. I mean, Amy Schumer's whole shtick, this is a whole other conversation. Yeah. But anyway, I'm not answering your question at all, but that's what I have to say.
No, you did. I think you did.
Okay.
Any other comments on that question, Geraldine?
Yeah, no, I mean, what you were just saying about if there had been one other woman on that board, things might have gone another way. And I do think that, you know, we do bring a different life experience. And, you know, I'm just going to put it right out there. We are, I think, better trained in empathy from a young age. And I think that it's valuable to have a lot more women in every room. Every room, there's not one room that wouldn't benefit from more women in it, in my view, because we do bring a life experience and that is different to the male one.
But it's so interesting. Are we better trained in empathy or are we intrinsically... more empathic.
Ah, now the twins are going to answer
well, that's
that
the question. Was. I think that's to your question.
We'll have to come back in 21 years, Megan, and I'll tell you how it turned out, right?
The current thinking in neuroscience is that the differences between male and female brains are not there. There aren't any.
I'm not seeing any so far, right?
Guy, do you want to comment?
No, you guys said it all. yeah, that's what they said.
Thanks, ladies. One of the things that I wanted to ask you is, today we've spoken a lot about the importance of our feelings, thoughts, and identity. But in order for us to really drive change, we also need action. And so I wanted to hear from you, what would be your call to action to all the people out there that have a shared vision for equality across men and women?
Automatic political asylum for any woman fleeing persecution.
Political asylum for more, well, it might be a different kind of asylum for
women that would want to go into politics, you know. But also, I mean, it's about getting our own lives together too, isn't it? That's the action as much as in every workplace or political theatre. I guess
stop apologising, but also recognise that within the context of feminism, people can feel different ways. It's not all one thing. I mean, I think so much of the problem with the way things get discussed, not just around feminism, but sort of around everything, is this sort of, you know, very fundamental inability to walk and chew gum at the same time. And it is so important that we are able to say, you know, we're both feminists, but maybe we don't agree 100% on everything. Mm. And there's all this sort of infighting and attacking, and it's exactly the kind of thing that makes people, men and women, whoever, say, well, feminists, you're all, you know, you're a whole bunch of crazy bitches. And it's so counterproductive. Huh? So stop apologizing and stop just being so narrow in the way we all think about things. Mm.
I would say we need to start looking at how do we use our voice? Because we do share things, we talk about things all the time. How do we actually use that to make people accountable? Because we don't exist within a vacuum. Our feminism doesn't exist within a vacuum. You know, Jalika Doe, or Miss Doe, who was an Aboriginal woman who was killed in custody, very little people have showed up to the protests about that. You know, those articles are shared, but we need to hold people accountable. So I would say, in terms of things like things that we can actually, political causes within Australia, I think that as feminists we need to get on is, you know, letting in refugees, but also holding people accountable. So look at Miss Doe, write to your local member, say that you're appalled, and so that her death actually has, there's repercussions for the people who let her die. I don't know. Like, I feel like we share things, we talk about things all the time, but how often do we actually make sure that the people who have power are accountable to us?
Clicktivism, they call it, don't they? Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting thing. But I'm with you. There are many layers of action going on. People often say things like, "Oh, you know, what's feminism doing about this?" And I think there is no organisation. There's no palace of feminism, you know. And they're writing out the policy on this, and women feminists go out there and do this now. It's a whole bunch of people with a view of the world, and they're all doing a million different things, and that's excellent. That's why it's lasted so long. The day it becomes a kind of church with a, you know, hierarchy of priestesses who decree what feminism is concentrating on at the moment is when feminism is dead.
Right. So the question should be, what are self-respecting, thoughtful people doing about this?
That's right. I agree with you. We have time for another question, or we don't? Where are we at time-wise? One more question. Who has the microphone? The magic talking stick.
Hi, I'm just, I guess, flowing on from that question about what we can do more. What are your opinions on, like, affirmative action and quotas? So, like, a really structural way of, I guess, promoting women?
Totally in favour. Nothing will change until we do that. That's my view.
Quotas are a means to an end. You know, we've been talking in terms of, like, I work in film and theatre and TV, and, you know, those numbers aren't rising significantly in terms of who's creating work, and that's such important because that's part of our culture and those are our stories and, you know, they help define us and evolve us. So, like, quotas are a mean to an end, and I'm a massive supporter of them. There's no such thing as affirmative action, you know. Otherwise, all men have benefited from affirmative action. So I would say, like, that idea, I would go behind, quotas. I think they're a must-have, at least in my industry. We need to have more diversity in women.
Oh, gosh. I feel like I need to take the fifth, because in America, the dynamics around this are really, really vast and complicated. I mean, I think that I'm not sure it needs... it really depends on what we're talking about. But if you're talking about women... I mean, I'm not sure that it needs to be institutionalized and a policy-driven thing that we, you know, have to mandate putting more women...
That's what quotas mean. That's what quotas mean.
So I guess I am against it, but I don't know what the dynamics are in Australia. So I would, that would be my caveat. So.
Yeah, I'm not for quotas either, particularly. But I don't know how you... I mean, you look at the Liberal Party versus the Labor Party. Are they quotas in the Labor Party, or is it? It's goals, right?
No, I think it's a quota.
Is it a quota? That goes against my inclinations on this. I think it's when you're forced to quotas, something's going to be missed, something that can keep up a momentum, I suppose. It's a sad state when that's what you need, isn't it?
Mm. I'd rather address educational inequality. I think, I can't believe we're dismantling TAFE. I can't believe we're defunding our public schools in the way we are. To put the resources into the education of women and then kick open the doors, we will walk through them if we're prepared properly in our education, and if we have equality at that level, the doors are open, there'll be plenty of women rushing through.
Just throw out there that, of course, that the current quotas that women are asking for are between 30 and 40%, and one needs to remember that if we're really after equality, we'd ask for 100% quota for 2,000 years, which is what the blokes had. You know, they had a quota, and it was 100%, and it was for 2,000 years.
Can I just share a realisation I had, though? When we talk about this idea of quotas, like, I mean, as a means to an end, is that, you know, one day there will not be quotas. But I have benefited from quotas.
Yes.
I went to university because my university had a quota. Mm. I had scholarships because my, you know, the scholarships came out of that quota. Otherwise, I would never had an opportunity to have an education. So I think, yeah, just, like, for me, think about me.
Barnaby Joyce is Deputy Prime Minister of Australia because of a quota. Okay? The National Party must be representative. We're against quotas for women, but they're fine for everybody else. I don't get it. Every organisation has quotas. Why
is
not?
Is Barnaby
for women?
Joyce the Deputy Prime Minister?
Yes,
of Australia?
He is. And
I think it's Warren. Is Warren Truss out of the country? Is he?
Well, maybe it's Warren Truss, but he's okay. In cabinet, whichever national.
I was just terrified.
It's a national. It's
See,
a
this
national.
Is why you need Twitter, right?
Yeah. It's a national. Has to be the Deputy Prime Minister because that's a quota. Mm. The Cabinet has to have X number from Western Australia. That's a quota. We're not shocked by that. Does poor old Warren Truss go around feeling like he's, you know, being disrespected because he's been Deputy Prime Minister because he's a National? Well, of course, he's a National. They all feel disrespected. quotas are a really interesting discussion, but we've run out of time. We can't have this discussion. We'll have to have it afterwards. Can we all thank these smart, wise... wonderfully funny women who are prepared not to have all the answers, which I think is one of the most wonderful things. Thank you all for coming and for your wonderful questions.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.